Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture with Bree. And Marty Gibson joins me now for Media Matters, as we do this time each week. Oh, good grief, Marty. I mean, the nice thing is that we've got lots to talk about, and we've even got things that we want to talk about and shelve from today to talk about separately because there's so much that's dropped. But how are you this week? Firstly, Diggins. Is Diggins out of the dog box?
Oh, she got caught in the chicken coop yesterday.
Hot diggity dog.
I don't know whether she's still, as my daughter said, raw dogging our eggs. No, she's been very anxious not to get any more chicken related trouble. She certainly hasn't eaten one, so that's good. But yeah, no, things good. Sun's out again after a lot of rain, and birds are singing. Chickens are clucking outside my window. I can reach out of the window now and grab a few eggs.
Well, there you go. Living the good life in the Papadopoulos. Yeah.
I'm allowed to have 12 emus, I found, reading the bylaws, or 12 ostriches in my backyard.
Oh, I just, you're now starting to throw off the whole Tom Good vibe.
Oh, yeah, well, let's get into it because, no, you've... You've
I know, I've got a busy morning. I've got a very busy morning. Big theme for me in the papers this week was you reap what you sow. And one of the things that you caught up with on Friday, which I haven't seen, was a really interesting piece from Matthew Houghton. Let's kick off with that.
Yeah, it does set the stage well. It's so good having someone who is functionally numerate writing in the paper because there's a bit of a shortage of them, but And this is where the media has failed New Zealand so badly, it is laying out the case for why we need to stop our public sector just endlessly growing, why debt's important. They're breathlessly reporting about inflation, but they won't acknowledge how asleep at the wheel they were while Squealer was printing all that money. Matthew Houghton in the Friday Herald laid it out saying it's irrefutable New Zealand has put itself on a path of bankruptcy since 2008. After a prudent 20 years from 1988 to 2008, New Zealand paying back our gross debt, the amount we need to service, Sir Bill English let it balloon by $56 billion over his eight budgets, an average of $7 billion a year. Against GDP, it jumped from 23 to 32%. Grant Robertson was, of course, worse. After paying off $4 billion in 2018 to 19, he borrowed $90 billion over his next five budgets. Across all six, he borrowed an average of $14 billion a year, taking gross debt to 44% of GDP. And as I've said before, when we have these articles and news stories about cancer drugs not getting funded, we've got to juxtapose it with that. That's why. That's why we can't just do it. It carries on like that, but the gist of it is, and he does say, to be fair, as much blame lies with voters. Since 2008, these three fiscal wizards will have increased gross debt by $212 billion. As a percentage of GDP, it'll be up threefold. No credible projection doesn't have it continuing to grow indefinitely after 2030. So he also says voters are to blame because they've wanted Singaporean levels of taxation but Scandinavian levels of handouts. It can't add up, and it hasn't for the past 16 years. Now, he does recall that when ACT was last in government with National, dear old Rodney Hyde, he doesn't say that, I just added that because he's
because
a good
he is guy, dear to our hearts, Rodney.
Know, forced Kian English to agree to Don Brash, wearing his economist rather than Orewa speech hat, to lead a working group on closing the income gap with Australia by 2025. So that involved us increasing productivity faster than across the Tasman. Economist Michael Reddell did much of the economics for the group called the 2025 Task Force, and Houghton helped with the media relations. But when Kian English received confidential courtesy copies of the report before its release, the Beehive immediately leaked the recommendations they thought would be most unpopular and trashed the whole exercise to TV political editors. And that was that. his conclusion is that he contrasts it with Norway, saying that 50 years ago, Norway decided to assure the sustainability of its generous welfare state and low taxes by drilling for oil. So established a company, and to cut a long story short, the Norwegian government's 70% share of that company, now called Equinor, is now worth 100 billion New Zealand dollars. Norway's pension fund is even more impressive now, with 2.7 trillion under management, and our super fund is worth less than 3% of that. If you factor in our KiwiSavers and private contributions, New Zealand has saved just 6% as much for our retirement as Norway. He's correctly pointing out that if New Zealanders are squeamish even about gas, what possible environmental argument is there against us searching for and extracting whatever undiscovered deposits of copper, chromium, molybdenum, lithium, graphite, titanium, bauxite, iron, nickel, and cobalt may lie beneath our land and sea? All are critical to support global moves to renewable energy. ACT might prefer the private sector, profiting most from expanding mining, but New Zealand First's very name demands the Norwegian model. National would go either way, depending on polls.
That sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, he does really give Nicola Willis a shellacking as well for continuing this path to, essentially path to bankruptcy, isn't it? Mm. And then, you know, you can move on. We both read the Stephen Joyce column, which talked about that protester mentality.
It did. And so the headline with that, so Stephen Joyce obviously said at a Herald, "Progress versus protest. The choice is ours. We can't afford to turn our backs on opportunity or we miss out." Now, both you and I had a ton of highlighter on this. One of the things I just want to comment on first before we dive into the article is the image that was of the protest there. I think it's the Auckland protest they've got there. And it's all the protesters out there. Now, one of the things that was really intriguing was at the Wellington protest, one of the criticisms by legacy media and those highly critical of that protest was, I think they called them a desperate group that didn't seem to know what it was that they were protesting. Now, that yardstick could be applied to this image, where I'm looking at this image, I'm seeing rainbow flags, I'm seeing tēnā tēratanga flags, I'm seeing Palestine flags because they seem to go everywhere these days, I'm seeing colonialism is not so hot, I don't know what that has to do about that fast track bill, nurture versus nature, kill
hold
bill.
Up my white guy, you push
it. Yeah, it, you know, there is a lot of mixed messaging going on in here. And I think it was one of the things that Joyce talked about, that sort of whole weaponized protest for protest's sake. And he opened it with a really interesting story, watching protests against the fast track process and sundry other issues last weekend. I experienced a familiar sense of unreality. A decade or so ago, similar types of protests were taking place in Northland. A vociferous group of anti-mining, anti-irrigation, and anything against the expansion of tourism. The particular tourism example was Carrington Estate, north of Kaitaia, where the Chinese owner who bought the property because of his passion for New Zealand had the temerity to propose expanding the accommodation to make the property profitable. It would involve more jobs, training, and so on, but some were not having it. Of course, the same group of protesters were offended at the perennially high unemployment rate that blights Northland. Almost in the same breath, they demanded the government provide jobs for the region, completely failing to see the inherent contradiction on their demands. It's hard to employ people in rewarding, fulfilling jobs if you go around shaking your head at all the opportunities that come your way. For Northland back then, read the entire country today.
Mm. Yeah, and that's so true. I get so impatient with, again, it comes down to a lack of ability in mathematics often. You know, you get people who can, with a straight face, talk about how cycle lanes will save the environment. And it's because they don't know that great, insightful figure from that Vaclav Smil article that I often quote, where an average person in an advanced Western society uses energy that's the equivalent of 900 people on exercycles around the clock. So there's your 899. You've saved one if you don't count all of the energy that's required to make that cycle track, all of the wasted fuel that comes when you slow cars down from 60 kilometers an hour to 40 kilometers an hour. But when you point that out, you get that narcissistic rage that Julian Genta had when a lady with a soon-to-close shop pointed to the empty cycleway and pointed out that she was having to close because Julianne had taken her park. Mm. So, yeah, there's a childish teenage toddler tantrum thing about this.
Well, you look at those sorts of numbers, as you said. I mean, how much energy was expelled to create the one thing and how little it saves. I mean, just think about how many needles had to go into how many arms in order just to stop a single person going to hospital.
Yeah.
You know,
that unreality had to be the image of perennial protester. I'll hold my nose to say his name so it sounds better. Russell Norman. Reading his speech to the gathering from his expensive, imported, made-of-minerals smartphone. Supremely unaware of the irony, I understand Norman forgot to cover how we'd all afford our smartphones or how they would even be constructed if we followed his policy
prescription.
Today's most environmental effects can be successfully managed without going to the extreme of saying point-blank no to development. But that's not what those in the anti-crowd are all about. The fast-track bill and the repeal of the oil and gas ban are just convenient whipping boys. They don't want any new developments at all and would close down much of what has been built if they had their way. If we don't reject them, we stand to get much poorer and much lonelier as more and more people shift overseas. And that'd suit them just fine. I can't remember which quango it was that was set up during COVID, but it was a group of academics that were funded out of Jacinda's office. It had a Maori name, I forget, but there was an East German academic out of Moscow who was lamenting how awful it was once the Iron Curtain came down and people were competing to see who had the best consumer items. But one of the pluses that was highlighted as a likely effect of the poverty from the COVID response was that it might decrease inequality.
Communism. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole thing is the contradictions that he puts in here. And he brings like that Norman one as a glaring one. The other one, though, too, is it's much easier to make a shorter list of what that government, i.e. the government of the last 6 years, was in favour of, which was, broadly speaking, creative industries and tech sector, both excellent sectors, but difficult with the creative sector that, for the most part, it doesn't survive without taxpayer subsidies. And then he talks about the tech sector, but, of course, the tech sector is also reliant on all of that big list of minerals that Houghton mentioned before. So it's this huge contradiction of, I just look at these laptop lifestylers and I just think to myself, you know, you're wanting your cake and eat it too, because you're all idealists. And as long as you've got your iPhone and your MacBook and everything is good for you and things are fine, yes, we're going to protest this because you can't make this stop. This is going to be too fast and you might affect a snail. Stop it.
I think it's even more banal than that. I think it's just I want to feel like I'm a good person, so I will protest against things that good people get angry about. And I think it's as childish as that. And so you'll get all these reactions if you confront them with reality. There was some hideous figure, and I can't put my finger on it now, but it was, you might have seen it, about the amount that had been invested in New Zealand movies by the Film Commission and the just pitiful return of them.
And that would have been actually, I think, potentially in that article that you read about the chap who was terminally ill.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. I think it might have been a follow-up to that, but it was less than 10% of what had been dropped on it. So, yeah, all of those things that are pointed to as the new productless products, that intangible products that New Zealand can make in our cool, clean, green future, yeah, really, they don't, like electric cars, they don't work without government subsidies. And once you start digging into the numbers, they really don't work at all.
No. As always, Joyce does like to offer his thought in terms of a solution, which is what I do like about him. He'll lay out a problem and then he will put what he believes is place that you could go. There is a sensible middle ground. Nobody is talking about covering the place in concrete or developing everything everywhere. A trip in the plane tells you that whatever industrial development we have, it's a tiny footprint on our landscape. And as we all know, it is in the farming sector's interest to also protect our environment. They have to live off it. We are at an inflection point. We can see from the last budget that government spending can no longer hold up the sky. It has to be a commercial investment. After the past 6 years, many companies I know, some of whom I currently work with, see the present Resource Management Act reforms as their last roll of the dice. After all, economic growth and prosperity remains at geographic play. If all remains too hard, they may just invest elsewhere. Progress is inexorable, and the question for us is simple. How much of it do we want to have happen here? How wealthy or poor do we want to be? And the interesting thing around that in terms of the fast track and reopening, you know, explorations for oil and gas, reopening them doesn't necessarily guarantee that those explorations will happen. I mean, word on the ground is a lot of these companies are already very gun-shy at reinvesting in a country that is so politically volatile on these ideological issues that this could all go out the window in 2.5 years' time if, you know, the current coalition or a mix thereof doesn't retain power. So well, they may just look at us and go, it's too hard.
Gloating about that. Tamihere said it. Your friend Shane Tupou had a really miserable, it sounded like it was written by a Labour staffer, his column, I thought.
He had some things that he needed to exercise, that's for sure.
There is an argument that could be made that this is a government recognising that it is likely to only survive for one term. Like Rishi Sunak's government in the UK, it is trying to get a series of changes through that simply slow down the progress of the next government. Ah, that progressivism, marching us towards that globalist socialist utopia, eh, Shane? And Tamihere said that as well. Said, we will roll this back. Don't come and invest here. It's economic treason. Because they don't have the guts to actually say what the alternative is. It's just this vague, revolutionary, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. It's weird. Yeah, it's not nice to watch.
Yeah, and here's another thing, though. He does say, this Shane Tupou, he says, but there is hope. Oh, okay, Shane. Senior management at National could step in and right the ship. The Ministry of Health just reported that New Zealand is experiencing its highest peak in COVID-19 cases since December 22. This is the hope. Okay, Shane. All right, good on. In April, the Ministry of Education announced that school attendance was being held back by sickness. Workers and families will need sick leave. The ingredients are all there for a sensible politician within National to realise that there's been some overreach and row this back. And this is in regards to the parity around sick leave, because up until now, that if you're a part-time worker, you actually get full day's pay, a full day in regards to sick leave, whereas the accrual, the parity that they're looking at, it's how it used to be back in the day. However many hours that you worked, a proportion of that worked towards what you would have in sick leave, which Elaine, like, duh, is common sense.
It comes from the, oh, those business owners have got so much money, they shouldn't be so stingy thing that those highly paid socialists have never employed someone.
And just, you know, that whole theme of you reap what you sow. I mean, in terms of, you know, kids away with sickness, I saw, was it Erica Stanford was on with just prior to the budget when she announced her plan, education plan, with Jack Tame. And did you see he was talking about the number of kids being away and literally tried to suggest that this was like a chicken and egg situation in terms of maybe the problem with all of these teachers is because all the kids are sick, so therefore that's making the teachers sick. So why don't you then want to keep the kids at home to stop making the teachers sick?
I mean, Shane Tupou's article was just a wrongly mess of wrongliness. It said, with unemployment due to rise by 47,000 on this government's watch, and they said, prices are still climbing despite promises to make it better, unfocused and unnecessary cuts to essential public sector jobs.
And speaking of promises to make it better, did you see Chris Hipkins' announcement about all the things that Labor was going to do to make it better?
I can't watch that guy. It's like when I try and watch Jacinda Ardern, I just get this awful feeling in the pit of my stomach, and just hear the sound, no, and then I realize it's coming from me.
You know, he literally stood there straight faced and said, you know, things like, you know, we believe in a country where we have a health system where people can actually access medicines that they need and the services that they have. We believe in a country where there will be no child poverty. We believe in a country that will have access to infrastructure and the ability to be able to easily get around with good public transport, all these things.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
we've got to start talking about how dangerous about 30% of people are. You know, Biden's approval rating still 36%. You think, how do you do that?
Mm.
How do you get that emperor has no brain delusionary? I don't know. It's deeply unsettling because you think, how can you not see that? And even the media, they just pussyfoot around it. The guy's falling asleep at that G7 meeting and just clearly out of his mind.
And then the latest one, when they were having the speech or something, and he just literally stood there, everyone's waving, and he's just literally standing there with his hands by his sides, looking like a deer in the headlights.
Obama.
And then Obama had to literally lead him off stage. It's like,
and you got stuff in you know, all of this coverage of Hunter Biden. Oh, you know, he was on crack. Yeah, that wasn't good. And he did buy an illegal firearm, but his brother's late wife, who he got hooked on crack and shagged, you know, threw it in a bin. That's one thing. I'm much more interested in the corruption around Ukraine that may have led to Biden starting a war which has killed 500,000 Ukrainians and God knows how many Russians and threatens to escalate into a world war. Let's talk about that. I don't care if a crackhead has a gun.
No.
Unless they live next door.
True. Just while we're in that sort of slew of opinion pieces, Heather Duplessis Allen, the other thing that was getting people head up was the fact that the expenses all came out for the first quarter, as they do, and we have the usual round of stories that, oh, this one spent this much on air travel, and this one spent this much on that. The other thing, too, that's reared its head again is the fact that MPs do get an allowance of up to $52,000 a year that they can claim in order for accommodation in Wellington if they're away from home. Well, a lot of the more savvy of these MPs, and it's not just the current government, it's everybody, all flavours, doesn't matter. The savvy ones often will buy an apartment and then claim that for they usually buy it through a trust or a wife or what have you, and then they claim that in order to
pay. And then they're stupid enough to use the word entitled. I'm entitled to it. I'm entitled to it about six times in one sentence, as Luxon did.
Yeah. So, of course, there's the optics around that. And, I mean, it is a rookie mistake from a PR perspective. They're going to latch onto this. And,
journalists don't make – Bob Jones pointed this out. Journalists don't make a lot of money. And so – they tend to be quite jealous and think that that's a huge – I mean, a lot of journalists don't get paid much more than $52,000 a year. And you can really hear the bubbling envy and, well, certainly old Tracy Watkins' Sunday Star Times editorial. What sets – talking about how she had to buy a house to move to Wellington. What sets us apart from members of parliament is that we don't have membership of a cozy club that sets the rules so any financial pain is passed on to taxpayers. Yeah, the optics are bad. I'm more interested in the stuff that Matthew Hooton was talking about, racking up debt so it's going to be $202 billion by 2041.
But it just shows you the editorial direction, right? So you talked about that in terms of the editorial with Tracy Watkins in the Sunday Star Times. Mm. Leading the business section in the Sunday Star Times is the headline, The Houses of Parliament. Now, I would like to amend that to the accidental Houses of Parliament. And I want you to answer me this, Marty. How do you become an accidental landlord? Because according to Celia Wade Brown, there are too many people, whether inside Parliament or outside, who just want the prices to keep going up and up so they can realise that these untaxed gains, says Green MP, an accidental landlord, Celia Wade Brown. Accidental, eh? Is this how you soften the fact that you couldn't live in your tiny home in Wairarapa and you didn't want to do the run over the room attackers, Celia, so you bought yourself an apartment?
All this problematic money. Oh, it makes me feel terrible. But I am doing a lot of good.
It is. It's really, I mean, this to me, this is the whole politics of envy rubbish. And it just detracts, as you said, from the bigger issues like the productivity, like the fact that things like this fast track bill, and actually the other thing that was announced a day or two ago around freeing up the consenting process so you can then go from a up to 30 square meter shed or dwelling to 60. Yeah. Great idea.
Yeah. And, you know, if you haven't got anywhere to live, I mean, my last year at uni, I lived in a garden shed. It was underneath a some sort of conifer that dropped cones on it. And sometimes my friends would go by from the pub late at night if I was had left early and was sleeping or somehow had managed to persuade someone to join me in my garden shed. And they'd throw fruit from a nearby grapefruit tree onto the roof, which was really, it was like being a snare drum. And it was, you know, as you can imagine, the middle of Waikato in winter. It was pretty cold, very cold. But the rent was cheap, and for me, it was worth it.
Mm. No, it will be interesting. I actually think that it's a really good way of helping. Like, there's a lot of intergenerational families now, which is quite normal in other parts of the world. But you've got lots of grandparents, parents, and grandchildren all living in dwellings, and that whole, I mean, the whole concept of a granny flat, I mean, that's where it came from. So to be able to create that vertical integration within a dwelling for those who are struggling to get on the home ownership ladder, it then means that they have an opportunity to live somewhere to be able to make that point. And one of the other interesting articles that I saw, which I think was in the Herald on Saturday, was the mortgage or baby. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did. And I'm struggling to find the actual article, but there was a statistic in there which just made my mouth drop open. Are you thinking what I'm thinking, Busky?
Oh, totally thinking what you're
thinking. There were a couple of thousand more babies born to women in their 40s than women in their 20s.
Yeah.
That's civilizational collapse.
Well, there were some really scary numbers in here. And in light of the fact that they've now opened up that, and this is where, again, the theme, you reap what you sow, okay? You pull it all together, and one of the elements, Paul Spoonley, he was interviewed. He said, people are delaying or putting off completely having children, and part of that mix is trading off what you can afford, including home ownership, said Professor Spoonley. Stats New Zealand released its latest fertility data last month, which showed New Zealand has experienced its lowest natural increase in population in 80 years. A fertility rate of 1.52 births per woman was a recorded low and well below the replacement rate of 2.1. It was a year ago. You and I did a story, and it was around education, and they were bringing up fertility rates then. And it was, 1.84, I think, from memory? So that's,
it might have been a bit lower than that even, but yeah.
That's plunging. Meanwhile, figures from Centric showed the average age of first home buyer has reached 36.6 years in the first quarter of this year, up from 5-year low of 35.7 in the fourth quarter of 2021. The average mortgage size now is just shy of $160,000, higher than it was in 2019, although almost $14,000 below the level of the peak in 2022. The average age of first home buyers has was 25 in 1970, so that just shows you the demographic shift. Most children were now being born to women in their 30s. The last year saw about 1,000 more children born to women aged 40 plus than women in their 20s. So more women are having babies in their 40s than they are in their 20s. That's terrifying.
Yeah. It's terrifying. I was going to say something about abortion, but what's the point?
Well, it's not even that though, Marty. I think I had a little bit of a think about that, because that number just, it really did sort of reverberate, because I had both my children in my late 30s. Now, that wasn't out of choice, okay? I wasn't doing the whole, oh, I'm going to delay it until we had this and we had this and we were secure and all of that. Literally, I knew I had a biological imperative from the time that we got married, and it was, we were off to the races. We've got to try and get these children born because of a health condition or a biological thing that I had going on. So there was none of this sort of social dilly-dallying around. But the other thing that they don't talk about in this article is actually the effect of social engineering on all of this. So the article's sort of trying to state that families have this juxtaposition between they can barely afford a mortgage because mortgage rates are so high and deposits are high and it's so expensive to buy your first home. So do you choose having a mortgage or having a child? Not once in here did it talk about how expensive it is to get education and the impacts of interest-free student loans on degrees that, let's face it, a good chunk of the degrees that these kids take part in are absolutely freaking useless.
Well, Paul Spoonley is kind of weirdly mixed up in all that stuff, isn't he? A lot of what he does is talking about how racist New Zealanders are against all of the immigrants that we need to bring in because our education's not fit for purpose often. And, you know, we've not really encouraged people to have families. And sometimes our governments seem to have gone out of their way to make it difficult for people to stay together as families in terms of financial incentives.
Yeah. The war against the family is almost, for me, a little bit like the war against mining and everything else. Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of a traditional nuclear family is being destroyed at its root by so many of these ideologues. Mm. And this is what happens. This is the result that you get. So, and they have the temerity to say, oh no, it's the raising, it's the high mortgage rates that have got, this is where the issue is at. And it's like, no, it's not. It's everything. Yeah. It's all the social, Marxist social engineering that you
telling
have
children for now. Yeah, that the world's going to boil in 10 years doesn't help either, does it? You don't want to bring a child into that environment. And you know, that's exactly what the Club of Rome wanted to do. They think there's too many of us useless eaters. They'd rather there were 500 million. And the system's working just fine for them.
Yeah.
They think there's too many people.
It is just utterly terrifying. And I think people, you know, these are some of the threats to look forward to. And then actually, I think it was in the same paper, did you see the one about the guy, I think it was Peter Hamilton was his name, he's the new board chair for Ryman Healthcare?
Oh, I didn't really read that one.
Again, you reap what you sow. Ryman's got itself in a power of poo. Now, they were one of the leading lights in rest care for a really, really long time. But for the last 5 years, they have been in a power of poo financially. The board have all sort of dissipated. He's been brought on board to sort of try and steady the ship.
Right.
It sounds like there has been a huge amount of financial mismanagement, but it's a really interesting thing. You know, you and I were talking about it. That are we going to be able to be, you know, our crusty old saggy buttered selves and free range rest homes in the day, you know, 20 or 30, 20, 25 years from now?
And free barn rest homes.
Yeah. I mean, all these rest homes are being built. I know here in the Bay, we've got several large scale rest homes that are under construction to catch that silver tsunami as it stands right now. But at the precipitous drop in birth rate that we've had across essentially a single generation, what's going to happen to all of these rest homes in 20 years' time when they're not going to be the people to fill them?
Well, houses generally. You know, the prescription's always the same for the West. Well, we'll bring people from Africa and Asia and India, but they never get around to selling it to people and getting them to vote on it because, of course, they wouldn't vote for it. It's not racist to bring that up as a topic. It's as you say, pretty alarming once you get right down to those stats and you just do a pretty straightforward projection of what happens to this country.
Mm.
And you always hear radical Māori leaders, well, like John Tamihere, boasting about how, you know, Māori having more babies and, you know, it's very, very similar in many ways to the Islamic strategy.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, there are so many things there. Just in the same newspaper, before I throw this newspaper away, again, you reap what you can sow. Health watchdog swamped with complaints. The HDC absolutely up to their eyeballs with a massive backlog as the government hears a plea for more funding. And the HGC, if you don't know what they are basically the complaints process people for all things medical. Things there have just absolutely exploded, and they exploded from 21, 22, 22, 23. And a lot of this is due to the effects of people unable to access, have delays in, or slip through the cracks due to lockdowns and also other unforeseen effects during that COVID pandemic period. You know, they're saying, hey, look, we need to look into this. But, and again, no one's looking at the calls. No one's zooming out, as you say, Marty, and looking down and saying, "What? Why are there so many more complaints in this period? Mm-hmm. Is it because people are more prone to complaining, or was there actually something going on in that time period that was creating...
funding cancer drugs because someone's had a whisper in their ear, hey, there's a lot more cancer these days. And it seems to, if you go and plot that graph and extrapolate. Did you read that? I've quite enjoyed Wayne Brown's columns, Why Do Big Projects Cost So Much in New Zealand? You know, we need, as I said, those numerate engineering types. I've always had a soft spot for engineers. They're crusty and they're, but I enjoy their minds. You talk to an engineer, it's always an interesting chat. He's talking about how, you know, how the last Labour government disastrously handled Auckland's ill-fated light rail project. They'd somehow managed to convince themselves that the surface light rail would cost around $400 million per kilometre. Then, not satisfied with that ludicrously expensive sum, they decided to go underground for an extra $300 million per kilometre. Thank goodness they never got started. But then he talks about a project in France, which took place in Angers, a city about the size of Christchurch. This project only cost $51 million per kilometre. So how did the last government convince themselves it would be $400 million a kilometre, especially when labour costs in France are higher? And he talks about the process of sourcing this kind of work and how flawed it is in terms of things that he calls the design philosophy, which is where he's talking about the gold plating of the Puhoi to Warkworth project, which specified excessive widths of the lanes, shoulders, median strip and bridges. Had someone with real cost experience been involved at that stage, at least $400 million would have immediately been saved. And Andrea Vance wrote a similar column about out-of-control council officials. Did you read that?
I did read that. I did. And you know what was really interesting about that Andrea Vance thing? You probably haven't heard the interview that I've just done with Mia Hughes. And one of the things that Mia talked about in her interview was a chain of trust. And the chain of trust that exists, and she did it from a medical context where you have juniors in a medical setting. And in the chain of trust, when you have a hierarchy, that if you're at the bottom rung or a lower rung, you have to immediately trust in the knowledge and the opinion of the person in the rung above you.
Mm.
And you look at things, chains of trust have been broken everywhere. And I thought Vance's piece actually spoke to that in terms of the chain of trust between councillors and their officials in council.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in that situation where I've been chaired a board at one point which provided services, and we had all this complicated stuff to do to remain compliant with our various contracts. And you're always counting on the people who are getting paid to sit there for all this time to tell you the truth. Often they don't. And you've often got board members who aren't really trained in accountancy and are doing a lot of things that aren't in their power bands. And it would be good if there was a system where you could get books looked over by someone who could really have a bit of forensic accountancy skill. But yeah, she was saying about the selling of the Wellington Airport shares. The council staff had never considered investigating the alternatives. They also told councillors a no sale would leave a $450 million hole in the city's budget, leading to reduced services and hiked rates. That conflicted with earlier documents released to the public, which said holding on to the shares would have no impact. So yeah, all of these little faceless bureaucrats in New Zealand, many of them who do a great job and work really hard, and you know, not to besmirch all of them, but there are plenty with ideological bents that don't get voted out with government.
No.
Like Carlos Costa, who should go?
Yeah, it really is. And the other thing too, said just prefacing that paragraph that you just read, in Wellington, a succession of poor decisions has been accompanied by a troubling mix of confusion and poor grasp of details by councillors. And that's really an interesting point, because I remember someone that I know here quite well, and they were the 2IC of the regional council here for a long, long time. And one of the greatest frustrations that she had with other people that she stood with on council, and she was there for a very long time, was a lot of them, she used to call them invitation harvesters, because they got themselves elected because they liked the invitations that they got that went along with it.
Pub sandwiches.
This is regional council, so there was a lot of environmental stuff involved in regional council. So she would read every single report that was placed in there. And I remember talking to a hydrologist who worked for the council at the time, and there was the big Ruatanifa Dam project, which didn't go ahead here, unfortunately. And he was saying that this particular councillor, he said, she's one of the few. He said, I worked for months on that report. I've tabled it. He said, out of all the councillors, I can tell you probably only two of them have read it, and she was one.
Mm. Should almost go in with their own group who do read everything. You know, because I'd imagine, I mean, whenever I think about being in Parliament, any romantic vision of it quickly gets taken over, but sitting, listening to all that boring crap and having to read just these hundreds and hundreds of pages of
I honestly don't know how our Jaspreet does it. So for listeners that don't realise, Jaspreet Boparai from Greenwash is a current sitting Southlander district councillor. And I know that she's one of the reads everything type councillors. I don't know where she fits it in, but she said you've got to, because it's the thing. Exactly. It's the stuff they try and slip past the goalie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it is rather interesting. Actually, over the page from Darth Vance's piece, or actually it might have been just sitting just above it or over the page from it, there was actually another headline that caught my eye, call to lift funding amid national crisis for health. And I thought, oh, here we go again. What's going on here? Australia. Australians are arriving at hospitals sicker as a health system buckles under years of decline, prompting states and territories to demand more money from the federal government. Everywhere in Australia, the health system is under pressure, a letter from 8 health ministers in the Commonwealth reads, describing the situation as a national crisis. As winter rolls around the nation, diseases and viruses such as COVID-19, the flu and RSV are weighing on a strained health system. General practice has been steadily declining for the past decade, the letter said, with fewer new doctors trained to become GPs. This means Australians are finding it harder to get primary care when they need it, the ministers wrote. Because of that, people get sicker and end up in hospital longer. Wow, look at that. The grass isn't greener across the Tasman as far as healthcare is concerned, or at least, you know, bottom rung healthcare.
Hey, I'll tell you a story that I found tucked into Friday's paper on page 7. And it was from Phil Pennington of RNZ. And it was about the boot camps for teen offenders to start next month. Now, do you remember the great hue and cry about Nationals' ill-named boot camps? Sometimes they just can't get out of their own way. That, you know, you get sick of Comrade Cindy's relentless PRing of names, that which they still refer to, like the smoke. Oh, you want to abolish smoke-free legislation? It's like, no, we just think it's absurd that in a few years a 36-year-old will be allowed to buy cigarettes and a 35-year-old won't. It's unworkable. What are you talking about? But anyway, so the boot camps. The first of the government's boot camps will start next month and will involve a lot less detention of the teenagers than expected. And if you read through this, what emerges is that National's boot camp system, again, like, shall I make up a name for it? Their potential recycler system, their potential salvaging young people system. Give me some time to
youth
work on.
Youth inspirational programs. I don't know.
Inspiring youth. Yeah, that's what you got to do. Features tell, benefits sell, Chris. Yeah, what emerged is a very enlightened sounding system so that they don't spend as much time in detention. For the following 9 months, the teens will be in the community with whānau involvement and one-on-one support from the same mentor. The launch is scheduled for July 29th with a first cohort of up to 10 young people aged 15 to 17. The three-stage pilot from July begins with an assessment of the offender before they are selected to join the academy and drawing up a transition plan. Yeah, they're looking to aim to set up an intensive mentor service for each team for the first 12 months. Same mentor works consistently with each teenager and their whānau at a one-to-one ratio as a continuous relationship holder. Alongside the Oranga Tamariki social worker, the mentor works intensively and in person with both the teenager and their whānau. That doesn't sound like the kind of anti-Māori lock them up and throw away the key kind of program.
It sounds really, really familiar to the work that was done by the great late Celia Lashley.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you, she used to run these incredible courses to help particularly disaffected young men, and she would often bring in their partners or families, exactly like that, with mentorship and self-improvement and actually rebuilding. There's a name. Because what you're trying to do with these young offenders is rebuild their own mana, yeah. Have them rebuild their own confidence and actually show what they can do by making themselves better, that they can make everything around them better. So
yeah, the sooner you can switch someone from concentrating on themselves to using their lessons to help others, the better.
Exactly.
And one of the measures of how depressed someone is how often they use the words I and me. The more someone thinks about themselves, the more depressed they get. They've done a literature review. The Foundation's research said that since the 1990s, boot camps began to shift away from the strict disciplinary styles towards a model that included tailored long-term support, therapeutic elements. They often retained military in the name, remained highly structured, and were delivered by military staff. However, the emphasis shifted from punishment to support and development. You wonder whether National have just kept calling it boot camps to satisfy the blue rinse voting contingent, just to avoid getting accusations of being soft on crime.
Yeah. Yeah, potentially. It's interesting you should say that because, they're calling them that from a hardline perspective. But I just want to get onto this before we roll on, because we've got quite a bit of feedback. Is the thing that happened yesterday, it sort of broke the night previous, was the broken promise. Well, Chris Bishop probably wouldn't call it a broken promise, but the softening in terms of the hard line, as it was called by Liam Napier in the Herald, on participation of trans-identified people in community sport. Now, that was part of the coalition agreement with New Zealand First. Bishop's wanting to take a wait-and-see approach on this, on the basis, he says, is a good quantity of feedback that has come from Sport New Zealand, which is now headed by Raylene Castle. Now, if you don't know who Raylene Castle is, she's ex-NRL Bulldogs / then Australian Wallabies, not that she succeeded much there. She's now come back home and she's now heading up Sport New Zealand. Now I thought, oh, okay, there we go, the volume of feedback, it'll be all the TRAs are all, out banging their drums and carrying on saying, you're not being inclusive enough for us and we have to be there. No. Her concern in the feedback that she'd received, what they were suggesting is no trans identified people participate in community sports, and that if they were to be allowed to participate in community sports, the government would consider withdrawing funding for those sports entities. However, Raylene is saying that if they do that, that there are people out in the commercial or the external land, and they will stop funding community sports and that they need that funding. And I'm thinking, well, who are these people? And then I thought, well, actually, they're probably the people that are on Bob McCroskery Family First's Woke Up website. Those people in the very woke, the Air New Zealand's, the McDonald's, the restaurant brands of the world. And Raylene's justification that it's actually good to take a wait and see approach on this. Is actually, there's not really that many trannies participating in sports because they don't actually feel comfortable. It's just like, really? That's the yards that you're doing, just like, oh, don't worry about men, trans-identified women in women's prisons, because there's not really that many of them and no harm will happen, even though one has now just been flung back to a male prison after a hammer attack. You know, it only takes one person, one woman, or even actually a trans-identified man as a physical, biological female going into a men's competition to be harmed, hurt, or killed, you're off to the races. It's just, I'm sorry, I've been a bit sized by that in the last 24 hours.
Yeah, it's just, well, you know, do the zoom out. When did the words trans start ramping up? When did the words racism start just sprouting like mushrooms in the media around the world? It happened around 2012, which was when the less freedom, more government side of politics, the left wing, started talking about Occupy Wall Street and this predatory privatise the profits and socialise the losses, started to say maybe that wasn't a good thing for society and we should do something about it. And meanwhile, the right, the less government, more freedom side of politics was saying, you know, maybe this big glob of cozy relationships between lobbyists and congresspeople and big corporations is detrimental to our democracy. The people who own the media really didn't want either side of politics talking about that. Much rather, we were talking about whether a man who dresses as a woman is a woman, and where, what toilets they should wear, and what sports they should they could participate in. All this, these absurdities.
It is an absurd. But the thing that annoys me on that basis, right, is that theoretically the coalition that we have is on the less government side of the equation, right? So I'm sorry, I'm sure, Chris Bishop, you've got a lovely pair of coconuts somewhere, darling, so you need to frickin' find them. Because
you remember
we know
what Christopher Luxon said, though? Anyone who worries about those sort of things is on another planet. Yeah, he's a shivering in search of a spine.
And this is the thing that concerns me. I mean, after all the optics that they've had on those 13 cancer drugs, and they claim that it's completely complicated. Now we have this. How many other things are they going to roll back? I think Tony Blakely is still sitting on that committee in terms of the COVID inquiry, and pressure still needs to be applied there. So what this says to me, for all of us who voted for coalition partners, or we were seeing where things were in the coalition agreement, I think that that's where we need to support those coalition partners, and we need to say, right, you guys need to put, you know, you need to talk to your key partner here, because this is bollocks. They had that agreement. Everything's going swimmingly, and now they're starting to roll things back. Why? Why?
Well, as Matthew Hooton said about, you know, whether we're going to get a Norwegian model or not, National would go either way depending on the polls.
Yeah.
They're not particularly principled.
Yeah. Okay. For me, the headline of the week was in the Sunday Star Times, swing towards populism could weaken G7 before next summit. Pesky democracy, how dare it weaken this G7?
Cam Slater said, let me just wipe away this very small tear.
I know. I could not believe that when I saw that. And the photograph on that with all the G7, I don't know what Modi was doing, but he kind of looks like he was doing a John, you know, he's from the Ministry of John Cleese's funny walks in that image, doesn't he?
Well, I don't think his leg's hidden. I think it's just one behind the other. But Biden is, again, you know, the emperor has no brain. Biden held one-on-one meetings only with Maloney and Francis, encountering the others only in group sessions or as they gathered to take photos.
All righty. We have got feedback.
Hey, if my phone wasn't broken, I would have texted you this morning and said, did we pick a winner of the Leader of the Week?
That is a good question.
Facebook post about it. Maybe we'll decide on it and put it up on Facebook.
That's a good idea. That's a very good idea. Laddie, 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 da.
Letters.
Oh, here we go. This is from Bryce. Loved hearing Marty talk about Rose Petty, a true tohuna who taught me a lot about Māori from a spiritual perspective. Many of today's Māori are caught up in ego, disconnected from who they are as spiritual beings. Love the show.
Beautiful woman. And her husband as well was a really, really nice gentleman.
Oh, actually, there's this one which I'm going to read out because I know that you'll appreciate this. This is, thanks, Marie. Wonderful insights with Trevor Larden. He really has a finger on the pulse. Everything he says makes sense. I just noticed in RCR Bites about the unrest in New Caledonia and thought he had pointed out that the CCP cause these unrests with race as an issue when there is no trade union to get communism in. We really need to wake up, and that's from Delwyn. Now, the interesting thing about that is we're going to do something quite special on the, there was an article about the influence of Chinese business interests in New Zealand with some regional mayors, which was done by Paula Penfold and Louisa Cleave. And they've also done a New Stuff Circuit documentary. And the reason we've not covered it in Media Matters today is both Marty and I agree that there is a lot there to unpick. And we're actually going to do a separate chat just on that topic and actually unpick it from our point of view, because there's some good work there that was done, but there was also gaping holes that you could drive a super tanker through. So we want to address that. And then this was actually some of my favourite feedback. Could you please send a special thank you to Marty and Marie? Although we love so many RCR shows, Robin and I like to make sure we catch these two chatting away. Marty makes us smile, often with his phrases that you'll never hear anywhere else, and they both show they are well-read and offer intelligent commentary on the media to keep the rest of us up with what's going on out there. Ta muchly and keep up the great work. And that's from Del and Robin.
Okay. Oh, thanks, Dylan Robin.
Thanks, Dylan Robin. We do appreciate that. And yeah, and just in general, lots of really positive feedback about what's going on and the conversation. So it is, keep that coming, 2057. And our inbox at realitycheck.radio is the place that you can send that to. Anything else? Any parting thoughts before we head off?
No, well, I think we're at the stage now, you can get bogged down in reading about the state the country's in and getting disorientated by just some of the incredibly weird defiance of reality that you see reading the media. And I think the more you can get together with other sane people and do things that make things better, the better, because sometimes it can take your energy if you're not careful.
Indeed. And actually, I want to give out a little bouquet to the team at Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab, of course, if you're here in the Bay, we're very keen to Rocket Lab because we can see the launches from here in Hawke's Bay when they take off from the Mahia Peninsula. Well, the team at Rocket Lab have actually come out. There was, it's in the paper about the Australian company that organises space camp tours for Australian and New Zealand kids to go across and experience space camp in the United States, and they went into liquidation. There is a number of Kiwi kids that have been affected and out of pocket by tens of thousands of dollars for these trips, and in fact one was due to leave this coming week. The reason I'm sort of quite aware of this is actually one of my son's very good friends has been affected by this. There's a group of young women from Napier Girls High School, I think it was about half a dozen or so, that have been affected. Rocket Lab, bless them, have said, well, look, we can't get you to space camp, but we will talk to everybody and get you up here to have a look around at our facilities, both in Auckland, and I think there could potentially be an opportunity for the local ones here to go and have a look at what they're doing out on the peninsula and just at least give something back to these kids that have a great interest in space. And I thought, good on your team, Rocket Lab, how to bring a positive to what is necessarily a negative situation. So I just wanted to say a big thank you to them. I thought that was great, great work.
Nice.
Right, my friend, well, we will do it all again next week here on Media Matters. Don't disappear, of course. My final thoughts of the day are coming up with some more of your feedback. And, of course, Natalie Cutler-Welsh is going to be here very soon with Up Your Rave. Thanks, Marty.
Thanks, Marie. Have a great week, everyone.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.